But last week, which was really 3 weeks ago because we had a couple Sundays off, we kind of went through just introduction to the nature of the issue. You know, what is an abortion? It's the intentional termination of an unborn child. And we kind of went through some of the different methods of doing so. And today, we're going to focus on history of abortion in the United States. Abortion's actually been around for a long time. I mean, there's been all kinds of ways that people have tried to abort their unborn children, from herb mixtures to actually doing things to the uterus to try to cause a miscarriage. It was officially banned early in the 19th century, and it kind of remained that way for a while until a couple of key cases, most notably Roe versus Wade. I think if you were to take a, you know, ask someone, do one of those Family Feud, you know, name a Supreme Court case, the number one answer would be Roe versus Wade by a lot. It's probably the one Supreme Court case that everybody could identify. And so this was taking place after a series of other court cases that were kind of challenging some of the laws and regulations regarding reproduction. Before that, there were a few other Supreme Court cases that dealt with birth control. And there was one, I believe, in Connecticut, where the issue was, can doctors prescribe birth control to unmarried women? And so that was actually struck down. And there was all this legal theory that kind of went into it, where they're talking about penumbra and emanations from the Constitution and something called a right to privacy. And so it really began to crystallize in Roe versus Wade. And basically, on January 22nd, 1973, I'll just read this. The Supreme Court ruled that an unborn child is the property of the mother. It concluded that she might dispose of it for any reason during the first 6 months of pregnancy, and at any other time, last trimester, if, in the opinion of a single licensed physician, it is necessary to preserve her life and health. During the first 3 months of pregnancy, abortion may not be regulated. During the second trimester, it may be regulated only with reference to protection of a mother's health. So in this ruling, how did the court's majority view the life of a child? As property. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is actually kind of an interesting opinion. Another famous Supreme Court decision would be the Dred Scott case. Do you know that one? Basically, it was, I think, before the Civil War. And the Supreme Court, I don't know the exact details. Do you remember it, sweetie? No? Something to the extent where the Supreme Court decided that if a slave was not afforded rights because he's the property of the owner. So almost the same legal reasoning here. But in their opinion, the Supreme Court was not willing to recognize the life of the unborn child. That was going to be a decision that's going to be left to the mother. Now, why do you suppose they supported increasing regulations as the child progressed through the gestation?
Maybe they identified,
what was that?
Or maybe they identified the property more as an actual life form, because it starts to look
more human. Yeah.
You know, even under the most oppressive slavery days, at the point at which you were 7/8 white, that's the point at which you're counted white. Mm-hmm. And so there's always this problem when we're assigning humanity and personhood, that at some point it becomes undeniable. They're like us. Mm-hmm. And so you see all this legalese trying to kind of parse out at what point can we no longer deny it. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in the womb. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think my understanding is the trimester thing was almost an invention here. It wasn't necessarily part of the accepted terminology. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
You're going to say something? Yeah, so it's a real interesting opinion that's very controversial. You know, many legal scholars, especially conservative ones, kind of see this as just huge judicial overreach. It didn't necessarily allow states to kind of define these things. And you see that there's actually another case that was decided with it, Doe versus Bolton. In a companion case decided on the same day as Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court struck down a Georgia law that placed several limitations on abortion. Any attempts to place limits on a woman's right to an abortion had to conform to a compelling state interest. It's important to note that Supreme Court justices interpreted mother's health to include her psychological and emotional health in addition to her physical health. And this is fascinating. So why is it significant that the term health was expanded to include psychological and mental health? How has this impacted our nation's abortion policy?
Psychological and mental isn't a measurable number.
Mm-hmm.
So if you feel bad, who's going to tell you you actually don't feel bad?
Mm-hmm.
You can't really prove it medically.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you can't do an x-ray and say, oh, your brain is overworked.
Yeah.
You can't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I think any time a person gets pregnant and they're not married, or even when they are married, I think there's always that moment of like, oh, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a normal reaction.
Yeah.
So if you don't have something saying, no, you can do this, then it's going to be very, it's going to be easier to go and have something done. I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
If it's an easy option to not do it, then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's to say which course of action is going to contribute more to mental health problems? I mean, having a generation where a quarter of them are committed matricide, you know, or committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kill their own babies.
Yeah. Yes, there you go.
You know, where you're making a generation of murderers, and they have to live with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, many of them do give birth and understand very fully what it is that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Talk
yeah.
about mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the justification for abortion, I mean, how many people would, do you think, have abortions because of health, like physical health issues?
Very few.
Very few. It's very rare, in fact. But by expanding it to the mental health element, one, who diagnoses that?
The patient
does, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of affirmed by a psychologist. But you look at, cancer has always been cancer, right? But you look at the, is it the DCMD, is that right? Or
is
diagnostics,
there
diagnostic DC, diastolic?
The DSM-4, yeah.
DSM-4. And just how many things that were wrong in 1973 are now okay now? And how many things that were okay then are wrong. Do you know what I'm saying? It's really a moving target where all you have to say is, I have an anxiety disorder about this.
Because the thing is, you cannot argue that. You can't, what somebody was saying, you can't prove it.
Yeah.
You can't measure it. And so you're basically calling somebody a liar. And no one wants to do that.
Yeah.
So
it really swung the door wide open for abortion on demand. Okay? So those are two very key cases that came down side by side. Then you have another one, Planned Parenthood versus Danforth in 1977. This case removed some of the limits that had been placed on abortion by Roe versus Wade, like spousal consent, parental consent for a minor child. The woman and her physician were the only ones legally involved in the decision-making process. Now, what's also interesting about this is the rationale behind this decision would allow for, like, if you were to have like a live birth, like an abortion went wrong and resulted in a live birth, the doctor would also have the discretion for allowing that baby to be born alive to die. Because this is between the mother and the doctor, and that's it. Those are the only two parties involved. Then you have Webster versus Reproductive Health Services in 1989. This case represented one of the first significant limits on an individual's right to an abortion. Reversing certain lower court decisions, the Supreme Court upheld a Missouri law that prohibited the use of public funds and medical facilities for non-therapeutic abortions. building on the Hyde Amendment. Do you guys know what the Hyde Amendment is? It was crafted in 1976 by a Republican congressman from Illinois that basically said that no taxpayer money could be used to fund abortion, because at that point in time, 300,000 abortions were funded by taxpayers. Okay? Now, nowadays, they give to Planned Parenthood, but that's not for abortion, it's for other services that they provide. Wink. But building on the Hyde Amendment that dealt with the use of federal funds for abortions, this case concerned the right of states to limit or prohibit the use of tax funds to pay for abortions. Okay? So that was actually kind of a win for the pro-life side. And then probably the second most significant abortion case would be Planned Parenthood versus Casey. So pro-choice proponents brought this case to the Supreme Court to protest limitations placed on abortion in the state of Pennsylvania. Casey was governor of the state. The state law in question required that a woman seeking an abortion give informed consent after receiving certain relevant information 24 hours before the procedure. Explanation of procedure, risk of abortion, probable gestational age of fetus. Informed parental consent for a minor child and evidence of spousal notification. The pro-life advocates regarded this case as the best opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade, and pro-choice proponents hoped that the Supreme Court would strike down all limitations. Neither side was totally satisfied with the outcome. The Supreme Court did not overturn Roe versus Wade, but retained all the limitations except the spousal notification feature. And then you have Clinton's withdrawal of executive support for the unborn. Although it does not belong in the legal court history of the abortion battle, one should remember President Clinton's contribution to this debate. On January 20th, 1993, while the annual protests against Roe versus Wade was going on outside the White House, President Clinton reversed more than a decade of executive support for the unborn with one stroke of a pen. He signed an executive order that did three things. One, lifted the gag rule that prohibited workers in federally funded health clinics from mentioning abortion as an alternative to dealing with unwanted pregnancy. He lifted federal prohibition against performing abortions on military bases and in military hospitals. And he ended the moratorium on federal funding for research that utilizes fetal tissue procured and induced for abortions. I think he also did the Mexico City policy where they allowed for funding, overseas funding, to go towards abortion as well. However, in his two terms as president, George W. Bush reversed the order and increased federal restrictions on abortion. And then when Barack Obama got to the White House, instead of doing it on January 20th, which is the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, as kind of a salvo to some of the pro-life advocates in the administration, he waited one day. So basically, every time we get a new president, this policy will reverse depending on their persuasion. Then you have Stenberg versus Carhart. At least 30 states have passed a ban on partial birth abortions. Shortly after Nebraska passed a law of this kind in June 1997, a physician who performs abortion, Leroy Carhart, filed a complaint challenging the constitutionality of the statute. In September of 1999, the Eighth Circuit Court, U.S. Court of Appeals declared Nebraska's partial birth abortion law unconstitutional. On January 14, 2000, the Supreme Court agreed to hear its first partial birth abortion case, Stenberg versus Carhart. Attorneys on both sides presented oral arguments for the case on April 25, 2000, and the court rendered a decision on June 28, 2000, overturning Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortions by a 5-4 vote. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, writing the majority, affirmed that Nebraska's law results in an undue burden upon a woman's right to make an abortion decision. Now, in the follow-up, they actually rewrote the law in 2003, and in 2007, partial birth abortion under certain conditions was ban was actually upheld. I think nowadays we're actually going to see there's been a bevy of new abortion restriction laws. And remember how we talked about how in the last 3 years we've seen like a decrease and decline in abortions? I think some of that might be behavior, but I think a lot of it is the pro-life movement has made a lot of headway. It's increasingly difficult to get abortions in certain states. I think Alabama has one more abortion. They only have like one abortion clinic in the entire state. In Texas, if you have people complaining they have to drive 3 hours to kill their baby. So there has been a lot of headway. So I think for those people who think that this is a losing issue, it's never going to change, when you look at the decrease in abortion, some of the legal battles and legal tactics that people have taken have been pretty effective. And so one of the, this new case that's being heard before the Supreme Court, in Louisiana, they have a law that says doctors performing an abortion must have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital. So if you have an abortion doctor who, which kind of makes sense, right? Now, naturally, let's just be honest, this is a way of trying to limit abortions, which is not a bad thing. But if you have, like, Louisiana, strongly Catholic state, and they have a Catholic hospital is not going to give that doctor admitting privileges, right?
Supposedly.
Yeah, supposedly. So that one's going to be, that's actually being heard by the Supreme Court. And depending on how that goes, some of the other laws, I think Kentucky passed one that says you have to look at an ultrasound at the baby before you kill the baby. There's fetal heartbeat bills and everything. So I think in the next 2 years, we're going to hear a lot of cases before the Supreme Court. If this one holds in Louisiana, we're going to see more there. And so there has been some success, which is why a lot of the liberal states are passing these draconian, you can abort your baby at any point in time, we don't care laws. Does that make sense? And so every time things go to the Supreme Court, it never bans, unless they ban abortion outright and say it's unconstitutional to do that, which is probably unlikely, what we're going to have is kind of a state-by-state issue where some states will allow abortion and some do not. Any questions about this? Yeah. And I think this is instructive. I mean, whether people know it or not, U.S. law is a teacher. It is a teacher. I know a lot of people will say, you know, people don't do drugs just because the law tells them to or doesn't tell them to. But anytime you pass, let's say, legalizing marijuana or legalizing abortion, in a secular society, that is right and wrong for many people. And so the fact that we allow it on the books, it is a teacher that this behavior is okay and is acceptable. But that's the current trend, but I think there is a lot of promise. I think there's been the pro-life movement has gotten more sophisticated as far as how to vet judges. Anton Scalia has come up with a legal theory called constructionism, which is to interpret the text kind of as it stands and as it reads. And we kind of know that when people look at the Constitution with that point of view, it wouldn't necessarily allow for abortion. And so that's been kind of a good increase where they've kind of gotten wise about that. And then I think, passing certain laws and trying to restrict certain things. In Texas, they tried to pass a law that put a bunch of building code issues on building any healthcare clinic, which Planned Parenthood clinics don't meet. So there is some progress to at least limit it. So all that to say, voting pro-life does pay off.
Well, and I mean, is this just a religious issue? Like, why should we care about what the government says about it? Because the first text in scripture that ever talks about anything related to government mm-hmm. is the Noahic Covenant, where it says, if someone sheds mm-hmm. blood, man's mm-hmm. blood, by man, his blood
yeah.
shall be shed.
Mm-hmm.
The very first thing a government is supposed to do is keep people from killing people.
Yeah.
And so for someone who doesn't do that one most basic thing, who cares what else they do?
Yeah.
That's not a Christian issue. That was given to Noah and all his offspring, which
yeah.
is all.
Yeah.
So that's why this isn't. It's not a religious issue. This is the whole purpose of government issue.
Yeah, it's to preserve and protect life of the innocent. Yeah.
What you said about constructionism, is
mm-hmm.
that... This is kind of a sidetrack to that, but like Roe v. Wade and
mm-hmm.
how they interpret the Constitution, is that what they talk about when they talk about overstepping, that they interpreted the Constitution the wrong way in order to decide how they did with Roe v. Wade? I guess kind of like the history.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer.
Well, we don't need to meet later.
We don't need to meet later. Not a lawyer. But this is my understanding. There's kind of two general lenses of interpreting the Constitution, which actually I think match two different ways that people interpret the Bible. One would be a constructionist, where you try to interpret the Constitution kind of as it stands. And people will point out that, you know, the Constitution allowed for slavery and all these other things, but the Constitution also allowed for amendments and allowed for it to be changed and transformed by the culture. You know, so the reason why, you know, a constructionist doesn't say that slavery stands is because the Constitution allowed for amendments later on to reinterpret it. Does that make sense? And so they basically take a literal interpretation of the Constitution and said, this is what the framers intended, and this is the charter that everyone's agreed with. Other people would see the Constitution as what's called a living document, that you have to listen to kind of the spirit of the Constitution and some of the assumptions of the Constitution and extract the principles of the Constitution. And so they allow for some flexibility in how they interpret it. And so when people were talking about birth control, they would say the Constitution has a right to privacy. But if you look at the original Constitution, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution itself. They say it's in the penumbra of it.
So that's like the spirit of the law and what people think someone intended.
Yeah. And so you look at how people interpret the Bible, right? We would say we have to look at the author's intent and what does it mean instead of imposing, because that guards us from imposing our view on the Bible.
Now, you're not a lawyer, but it sounds kind of ironic that, isn't that hearsay? Mm-hmm. To intend what someone means without them for literally saying it, like in court?
Yeah, I think that's the weakness of it. And I think what they would do, their classical argument would be, if we were to stick by the original Constitution, then we would still be affirming slavery. But that's short-sighted, because the Constitution has built within it ways to amend it and to change it so that you can still read it literally and see that slavery is no longer acceptable. So the constructionists don't say that the founding fathers were infallible, but they do say that the government charter allowed for some changes to adjust with society, and to go ahead and reinterpret it is basically to allow the judicial branch to make laws and to legislate. And that's not the job of the judicial branch, that's the job of the legislature.
The question is, are we or are we not bound by the rule book for making the rules?
Yeah.
And so those who believe in generational law, which is, we would typically say, the left, they actually don't believe that we're bound by anything that our forefathers did, including their rules for how we make our rules.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically whoever has the power gets to dictate it. That's what generational law says.
Yeah. And it was really interesting in the run-up to the Civil War, when they were having all of these conversations about slavery and the legality of slavery. Abraham Lincoln would never say that slavery was against the law. He would say that slavery should not be expanded. And he got really nervous because many of the abolitionists and the the people who are opposing slavery would say that we're actually bound to a higher law. And that was something that was kind of edgy, because they're basically saying that we're not bound to the Constitution, we're bound to this higher law. And Lincoln did not like that language. And that's why, you know, he eventually worked to have a constitutional amendment so that the law actually worked, and he still upheld the Constitution, even though you could say he kind of violated it in some other areas. But, and so when people start talking about a higher law, or which we are bound to, but to say that should be the cause of policy when we have a document that allows for it to be changed and transformed, we should go back to it. And we haven't had a constitutional amendment since I don't know when. I don't know when we had the last constitutional amendment, but it would be good to pass a few, just so that people can remember that we don't need to, that we do have a method of updating it, because otherwise it just seems like it's just so static that you have to reinterpret it to allow it to meet your objectives.
So the standard for an amendment is what? 2/3 of the Congress and 2/3 of the states?
I think so.
3/4 of the states.
First state.
It's really high. It's hard to get that.
It's hard to get
especially
it done.
In this political climate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So speaking of slavery, when Lincoln came up with the Emancipation Proclamation, was that like a, you know, it's like him just saying that, or was that, when did that become?
That was an executive.
That's an executive order type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way that they got it passed as an amendment is that all of the Confederacy had withdrawn, so
yeah.
Getting 3/4 of the states to pass it was now
right.
Very easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. With Confederate states out,
so
then.
It's a matter
yeah.
of timing.
Yeah, never waste a good opportunity.
Clinton
yeah.
said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
So how do other countries handle abortion laws? Do we know much about? We know ours.
Well,
really
it's interesting. In Eastern Europe, abortion was a form of birth control.
Mm-hmm.
So incredibly high abortion rates there. Same thing with communist China. And it makes sense when you have a secular worldview where you don't necessarily believe in God and you don't believe in the image of God, man being in the image of God, then, you know, it's might makes right. Some of the more religious countries, like for a long time, Ireland was the one holdout in Western Europe, but they were kind of a very deeply religious country, and they just allowed for abortion maybe a couple years ago. And they kind of speculate that the whole Catholic abuse scandal just basically turned off the country to the Catholic Church, and so kind of opened the way for abortion. So the more secular a country is, the more they allow for abortion.
The U.S. has the fewest restrictions on abortions of almost any country in the world,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that you can kill your baby all the way up to the end. In most parts of the world, it's very, very easy in the first about half.
Yeah.
Like, Western Europe, most of Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
that's how it is there. Very easy, and then it's almost impossible beyond that.
Because there's no health need for it.
Uh-huh. Well, and because it starts to bring complications. Right? So it's very common in those early months, but they think we're barbaric for allowing it later because it's very difficult, the way
mm-hmm.
you have to do it. It's very bloody. It's very, you know.
Oh, I guess end up delivering
time.
The baby anyways, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
A baby.
Yeah.
So they actually think that our laws are kind of barbaric. Like, come on, guys, fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Partial birth abortion was just, that's just infanticide. No doubt about it. Yeah. It's a good question.
Yeah.
You're going to say?
There was late term abortions before partial birth was thought of. You know, George Taylor did saline solution abortions.
Yeah, man.
On third term babies years ago.
Yeah, he was like one of the only.
Yeah.
People would come from Florida to Wichita to get abortions because of that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think? Can we comment on what you think about people saying that the way to tackle this is to prosecute it as try to get this actually. But we change the way we think about it as we always say it's murder, but be willing to prosecute mothers and physicians who are doing this. Because there's a group out there that's basically saying unless we're willing to say that, then we don't really believe that.
Yeah, I would say I would prosecute abortionists, not necessarily mothers. I think the reason why is I think a lot of mothers are manipulated into this. I don't think they're quite as, they don't share the same level of culpability. Maybe some do, but legislatively, it'd be that'd be a very difficult one to pass. Realistically,
right.
Now some mothers do intentionally kill their babies. You know what I'm saying? That's between them and the Lord. But in the court of law, that'd be very difficult to prove. Where you have a lot of scared teenagers who are pressured by their boyfriend, right? They are go to an abortion clinic and they are kind of told the propaganda, they're told that it's okay, they're told that it's a procedure, and they're basically deceived into passively allowing themselves to have their baby murdered. You know, the person who does the actual killing is the abortionist. They're the ones who raise the knife, so to speak. So that would be my thought. Any of you guys have other thoughts? What do you think about it?
I would say if you're willing to do it, then you're murdering your child. And that would be a bigger scare. If I
think in the 70s and early 80s, you might have been able to get away with the mothers being kind of naive
does. But I think at this day and age, you're kind of getting to the point where everybody knows.
I think the problem is murderers should be prosecuted for murder, and everyone who aids and abets should be, right? Nurses,
mm-hmm.
everybody. But legally, we are still a number of steps down the road from that.
Right. No, I understand.
You have to make it
impossible, practically.
Yeah. Make an agreement that if you create a child, you're responsible for it, which means fathers.
Right.
Right? We have to bring that back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just, because who's really responsible for killing the child? Lots of people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The one who won't pay to take care of him, the one who
mm-hmm.
is pressuring her to get rid of, like, all of that. So, I mean, legally, you're so many steps down the road
yeah.
from that I think from a strategic point of view, it's kind of futile to start saying, we need to do this, because that's impossible
yeah.
now and quite a ways down the road
mm-hmm.
from where we are.
No, I understand that pragmatically speaking, it's like,
yeah,
can't happen, but.
Yeah, I think you can, and it can make a line between the active and passive
mm-hmm.
party in it.
Especially for those who don't even pay to get it done. I mean, they're trotted down there by the boy, you know, the government pays for it.
The parent.
Mm-hmm. With the parent. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are definitely cases where a woman is paying someone to kill her child, and there are cases where a woman is crying and weeping and not wanting it to be done, and it's done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true.
Yeah.
So parsing all of that out, I mean, I just think we're so far down the road from being able to effectively do that
mm-hmm.
that we almost kind of
yeah.
needlessly turn the culture away from the argument, because we still need to work on the personhood of the child, making
yeah.
sure that we agree on that.
Yeah, and I think murder is about intent. And I think it's theoretically possible for a woman to have an abortion without the intent to murder. Because of manipulation, coercion, and some of those other things. Now, I think for the abortionist, the intent is always there. The intent is to terminate this unborn child. So that's why the culpability, I think, is greater with the abortionist. Although some others do have the intent, but in a court of law, that'd be difficult to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else have something they want to say?
Could you argue that intent is what separates abortion from a miscarriage?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, miscarriage is like, you have no
control.
You have no control over that. That's a spontaneous thing.
Yeah, it's intent that leads to killing.
I mean, people will like say, well, they can cause a miscarriage, but at that point, it's just an abortion. If it's a miscarriage, then you can't do anything to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the strict definition of murder, you need to have an illegal killing coupled with intent.
Mm-hmm.
An illegal killing without intent would be manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you look at abortion, it's an illegal killing in God's eyes, which is what counts, and there is intent to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's second degree or first degree, I think it's always first degree murder for the abortionist.
I'm just thinking back to when we had our first discussion, and you know, we saw the numbers were going down,
mm-hmm.
and I think someone was saying that it just could have been because the definition of abortion has changed, and so many things that used to be abortions in the 90s no longer are considered abortions, even though it's still murder.
Like, what are you talking about?
It's not in this packet, I couldn't find it, but I remember when we first talked about, like, abortions dropped drastically when they first started recording it in the 90s. And so...
But we have not yet figured out whether that includes...
The table was by
mm-hmm.
a pro-abortion...
The Guttmacher Institute.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Guttmacher Institute, I mean, they... Giving them the benefit of the doubt, they want to statistically track abortions. Now, they are a pro-abortion institution, and they did have to do some guesswork. But I think...
They're pro-abortion?
I believe so.
If they're pro-abortion, then they're not trying to give the most accurate numbers.
Yeah. I mean, by that logic, then anti-abortion is also not trying to give accurate numbers.
Yeah.
But that's
no
true.
One's trying to give accurate numbers.
I mean, one side wants to inflate and one side wants to
do it. I agree. But I guess my whole point is with this, if we're looking at what the definition of is intent, if you want to reduce or raise abortion numbers, all you have to do is just change the definition, how you determine the definition.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But I would say, too, like in the 70s, there was no pro-life movement in 1973.
Okay.
It was really interesting. You guys know who W.A. Criswell is? He was a pretty well-known pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas. He was actually pro-abortion. I mean, many Christians, evangelicals, thought for a long time, you know, the whole story of the single mother forced to have a kid, living in poverty and stuff like that, many of them thought that it was okay to have an abortion. There wasn't a lot of resistance to abortion when this came out. There wasn't an organized pro-life movement. The pro-life movement began to take place after this. And I think their primary purpose was to try to get Roe versus Wade overturned. And then I think when, like, you look at that Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, when it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, some of the strategy was shifting to crisis pregnancy centers. Okay, so trying to get the word out, trying to educate people for what it is. And then they started to look at other ways of limiting abortions by trying to close abortion clinics and then trying to target partial birth abortion. So I do think there has been some success in limiting access to abortions by shutting down abortion clinics. And you look at Texas, Alabama, a lot of places in the South, like you look at Kansas. I think there's one abortion clinic in Kansas now, in Wichita. Wichita, there might be.
I think there's one in the Kansas side.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there. I don't know, but.
So I don't actually want to look that up because I want to say I don't know.
I think the ultrasound technology has done a lot to kind of help our cause, where when people are pregnant, they have a picture of the baby. You have, I think, even gender reveal parties. So, I mean, there's a lot of things culturally that has kind of raised awareness of it that I think really kind of helps the pro-life movement, which is why I think a lot of Planned Parenthood is panicking. I mean, it's...
Have you ever looked into how Planned Parenthood started?
It was eugenics.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Yeah.
The lady who started was like a well-known racist and purposely
mm-hmm.
built Planned Parenthoods in low-income...
Yeah.
Black neighborhoods so that they could kill black babies. Which that, mm-hmm. I'm like, I look at that now and I'm like, well, why would you want to support that organization?
Yeah.
Especially when a lot of the people who are pro-choice are
yeah.
far leftist and
mm-hmm.
are far against white supremacy. And I just, I don't
yeah.
get it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think a lot of the times when you hear people, which I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, the two biggest arguments that I hear or
mm-hmm.
see is people attacking pro-life
mm-hmm.
and asking us, well, what about those rape victims, even though rape is like less
mm-hmm.
than 2% of abortions,
mm-hmm.
and then attacking the church for not doing enough for orphans and...
Yeah. I mean...
So that may be a
discussion not doing enough,
time,
not doing enough for orphans is
a lie. Yeah. Because
it is a lie. You look at foster care, foster parenting, adoption... The foster system would collapse without Christians.
Yeah.
It would collapse. And so when people say that we don't care enough for it, that is just an outright unsubstantiated lie. And I would denounce it just as strong. I would just say that's just a lie. Absolute lie. We have foster kids in our church. We have people taking care of orphans in our church. We have crisis praying. The church does way more for these than any other volunteer organization. Now, the government does a lot because that's what they're paid to do, but they have unlimited resources and a monopoly on power to do it.
So what exactly does our church do? You know,
if
one of the girls in our youth group got pregnant, I mean...
It's happened.
Yeah, I'm sure it has, but what is the... I mean, I don't know. What's the...
What do we do? We support the mother, have a baby shower. We, there would be multiple offers to adopt a kid.
Every time. I just want
to
be able to say that if
someone
asks me.
To adopt.
Well, that's what I'd like to be able to say.
Joe
that.
And I have a standing policy that if we come across a crisis pregnancy in the emergency room, I offer every mother to take that child. We had one almost, and that was it. But most of them have kept them.
Yeah.
So it's like, we just have said between ourselves, like, this is what we will do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we know plenty, now that we're getting older, we know plenty of people who would do it.
Sure.
There is no shortage of newborn babies that have offers to have homes.
There's no shortage of offers for
any baby.
Newborn babies are the hot commodity.
They are.
Oh yeah.
Any they'd be adopted like this. There's a waiting list for those, and many of them are Christians. And I think you even look at our church. I mean, Do we have double digit foster kids in our church right now? Or in the foster system? I think so. So you find another volunteer organization that takes in as many orphans, who does as much foster care. And I mean, that's why I think a lot of these adoption agencies that are kind of caving into LGBT, they should not do it, because everybody knows the foster system would collapse if evangelical churches stepped out.
The power's on their side if they would just stand
We've got the leverage on our side, because it would collapse. I would say half of foster kids are probably in evangelical. I can't substantiate this anecdotally, but half of them are probably in evangelical homes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I would say. It is such an outright lie. It's amazing. But you know, it's easy to be sanctimonious and say that's what we do, but that's Christians in general are the most generous people in the U.S. They donate more to private charity, even non-Christian charities, than seculars do.
Yeah, we donate more to secular charity than seculars
do,
statistically, per person.
Yeah, so don't buy the propaganda. Okay, was that helpful?
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, I agree. But yeah, that's what I've said before. It's nice to hear the way you say it.
Yeah.
We have always, though, had the policy that, I mean, we welcome every baby.
Yeah.
And if that baby was, you know, conceived because somebody slept together, well, guess what? The sin was sleeping together, not the baby.
Yeah.
I mean, we just had that recently, even here, right? I mean.
Yeah.
And church came around them and supported them, and they're doing
it. It's happened multiple times.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that was the answer, but I just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if that wasn't the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see. About 5 minutes later. Any other thoughts we can camp on this before we talk about positions on abortion?
This doesn't mean you want to lower the abortion rates, make it murder.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think a lot of people would not do. I don't want to kill anybody. You know, I mean, I don't want to go to jail or prison for killing someone.
Yeah.
And if you're hiring someone to do it, then that would be no different than hiring a hitman to kill my wife.
I'm not.
You're hiring someone to kill someone.
I think it's the same thing. It's really desensitized it. It's just
absolutely
a medical procedure.
Yeah.
We're just going to perform a medical procedure.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you're going to have some mild cramping. You know, it's going to be like a heavy period. Whereas I think if a doctor had to sit there and look a mother in the eye and say, "Do you want to murder your baby?"
Well, do you want to go to prison?
Yeah.
Because that's where you're going to go with prison.
Yeah.
With all the murders.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you want to share a cell with me? Because we'll both be going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is something where I think how we frame the question is very key. You say, is abortion wrong or is abortion murder? Because you have many Christians who will say, well, abortion is wrong, but so is war. You know, so is allowing people to starve. Huh?
Overeating.
Is it wrong? Should we try to reduce it? Okay, versus is it murder? Brings it into a different category of justice. And so I think many people who are more on the progressive side of Christianity will say it's wrong. But will they say, is it murder? And that's what I always press people on. So do you believe abortion is murder? Well, you know, is that fetus made in the image of God or not? Okay, so that's going to be the ethical question that we're going to talk about and discuss as we kind of move through it. Is it wrong versus is it murder? Or you could say, is it right? Okay. Other thoughts? All right, we'll get into the biblical argument next week. Let me pray for you guys. Well, Father, I do thank you for this opportunity to talk about one of the great injustices in the U.S., and I pray that you'll give all of us indignation at the murder of the unborn children and a desire to fight it and to do what we can to save the little lives. I pray for this next section of our worship, Lord, that you will be honored in the teaching and the communion and the giving, as well as the singing of praise to you. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.